if that not baby's not breathing, gosh, you really want to breathe for it. Like that's how I teach it. Like if you're hungry for air, wouldn't you want somebody to give you air? Like, isn't that a gift?
Welcome back to the Midwifery Wisdom Podcast. This week's episode is a treat for everyone. Augustine Colebrook has the chance to sit down with NRP instructor Julie Moon. Julie shares a wealth of knowledge on this incredibly important skill. She shares a bit about the work being done to translate NRP to community-based birth, the evolution of NRP across the decades, different tools for NRP accessible to community-based midwives and providers, and some of her hopes for the future of resuscitation in community-based birth. Get out your notepad and a good snack and be ready to learn from this incredibly educational episode. Here we go.
Well, welcome to the Midwifery Wisdom Podcast. I'm so excited that Julie Moon is with us, NRP instructor extraordinaire. Will you give us your intro? Where are you in the world?
I am in Salcha, Alaska, which is just a little bit south of Fairbanks, so way, way, way up north. It's still very, very cold outside, and I travel and teach NRP mostly at this point is what I do. I do a little bit of home birth with a local home birth midwife here. I was at the birth center here for about 8 years, and then prior to that, I did L&D nursing in tiny community hospitals in Kodiak and Ketchikan, so on islands, so it felt really similar to birth center sometimes.
Yeah.
You and, another nurse if you were lucky. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, what got you into birth work? How did you enter?
I entered birth work kind of in a back doorway, like a lot of people do. I intended to be an obstetrician from about the time I was 6 years old. Got perfect grades so I could get into college because we didn't have the money for that. And realized that's actually not what I wanted to do. I saw my cousin's birth, and she was a VBAC induction, and the nurse was with her for about 14 hours. She stayed past her shift. And I had been telling the nurse the whole time, I'm going to be an obstetrician. And she was just like smiling and nodding. And then the doctor breezed in, caught the baby and left. And I was just stunned. I just couldn't even comprehend. I had literally spent 20 years pursuing this dream and didn't, I guess, quite know what the dream was. And I told the nurse, I said, I don't want to do what he did. I want to do what you did, only I want to catch. And she said, oh, honey, you want to be a midwife. And I was like, what is a midwife? So that sent me on that journey of figuring out what a midwife was so that I could be one.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
So awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what got you into the NRP profession, resuscitation?
Yeah.
You had some bad resuscitations. Did you, how did you get interested in this?
Yeah. I was a brand new nurse, and it was, it's sometimes a little cowboy up here, and I was a brand new nurse, and I was alone a lot and had some really, really tough things happen that I just thought within my first year of nursing, where I went, I don't ever want to feel like I don't know every single thing about this again. I want to know everything I can possibly know. And so one of my mentors was an NRP instructor, and she told me, I think you'd be a great instructor. I think you need to train to be an instructor, because the more you teach it, the better you know it. And I just have been doing it ever since then. It just really became my passion, definitely in a community hospital. It was really relevant. Sometimes as an L&D nurse, you don't resuscitate the baby. You just hand it off to the NICU team. In a community hospital, you're literally it sometimes. The obstetrician is not skilled at NRP. They have it, but that's not their area. If it's a family practice doc, they may step in a bit more. So you're it. And so, I spent 14 years being it in a community hospital and just really loved it, really realized that similar to birth center, the NRP model that was coming down the line of, oh, we can just check you off. Oh, we can just do, you know, a quick 2-hour course and you'll be good, was not sufficient. The NRP model, and I love NRP. The NRP program, I think, is one of the best programs out there in terms of really paying attention to what matters. Like, we need to do this to save a baby, and trying to dial it down to doable science, achievable science. But they don't, they're very NICU based. They're very NICU centric. And so they don't have this realization of either the reality of being one or two people in the room or the tools that might serve us best. And so really the community hospital was the jump off point for me for that, saying, you know, what can we do with me and my charge nurse? What can we do with me and an ER doc? What's achievable? And how do we achieve this high level NRP immediately before we call a code team in, before we have those, all of those hands like the NRP videos show, you know, because that's usually not our reality. So then when I hit the center, it was just obvious, like, this is translatable. I can pull this from the community hospital to the birth center. We have two people. We can do this. We can do what we did there here.
I want to get into that protocol and a lot of the teaching you created. But before we do that, I want to do two things. I want to do some definitions for our listeners. Okay. But I also want to ask you a little bit about your awareness or comparison between helping babies breathe and NRP. Because a lot of midwives facing what you face go, oh, we're a low resource environment. We should focus on helping babies breathe. And I see you kind of translating NRP into this lower resource environment. Tell me about your thoughts on this.
Right. Well, first of all, I want to be clear. The most important thing that you're ever going to do is help a baby breathe. And we focus on that intensively in our class. The higher level NRP is going to be the least frequent thing that you do. The most of the time, you need to give really excellent breaths and ventilate that baby really excellently until they have improved. And the NRP data shows that that's going to be the majority of your resuscitations. And about 1% of the time, you're going to have to move further. But so helping babies breathe really focuses on that one thing. And in, like you said, the lower resource settings, it's incredible. I think that we, as you said, have focused on for 20, 30 years as community hospitals, as community birth providers, and I would add EMS in there. So my beginning of my career was in EMS, have focused on this is all we can do. And I think accepting the reality that we can do more and we can do it with more refined tools. So I think one of the single biggest things that community birth midwives that can access that they don't think they can is a T-piece resuscitator. That's a higher level NRP. It's still breathing for the baby, right? But it's with a more refined piece of equipment that provides a lot of benefits to the baby. And so I feel like, and I taught recently with some Indigenous midwife communities, and they just had a really good discussion about it. And really the discussion was helping babies breathe is appropriate in settings where you don't have a hospital to transfer to, where you don't have this higher level care. And you have to acknowledge that if we're not able to make this happen, we're probably not going to save this baby. That's not the reality for the majority of us in the U.S. The majority of us, even up here in remote Alaska, have somewhere we can take that baby where we can get them to that higher level of care. And so being able to walk through the steps, I think it's really important.
And I love that.
Why it's not just I think it. I have lots of reasons for why that I can discuss with you if you want.
Yeah, I do. And I really love that distinction. And I hadn't thought about it like that before. I'm just going to parrot it back to make sure I got it right, because yes, I think absolutely. This is a really important learning piece. The idea being that helping babies breathe as a curriculum is really effective in most babies and appropriate as an end stop to care when there is no other resource. Because we need a higher level resource like NICU to keep babies alive who need prolonged resuscitation. And we can't do that in such low resource environments. That's a real aha moment for me. So for those of us that work maybe with less people, but in a community, even an hour or 2 hour radius community, yes. where we can get them to a higher level of care, then our job stops being about this, well, we did our best, and it moves to being like, how do we stabilize them for transport so that they have a bigger chance? That's correct. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, exactly. That's really, mm-hmm. yeah, that's really where I feel it's at. And that actually becomes even more important. So when I teach this, if you're in a birth center, that's 3 minutes from a hospital, right? Because we go into intraosseous administration and medication administration, because there is the rare time that that is going to be what a baby needs to save their lives, right?
Yeah, and I really want to hear about this. Yeah.
In an interruption. Keep going. And so, and it's rare. It's, you know, the data shows that that's probably a once in a career thing. But it also shows that if you're that midwife that it happened to, and the tools were available, and you didn't access them and have the training, you're devastated. And so are the parents.
And potentially liable.
And the parents think you have the skills to do that. That's super important to understand. As I work with more and more parents, I'm working with some foundations where parents lost babies because of the failure of a midwife to resuscitate. And they're just stunned that the midwife didn't have that level of training. We can fluid resuscitate a mom. Do we have that skill if the baby is hypovolemic? So I encourage people to just ask those questions. I'm not saying I have all the right answers, but I think for a long time, we haven't been asking questions. We've been saying, we don't do that. We can't do that here. And so I just think opening up those questions and saying, but why? And I'm a question person. That's my thing. I drive people crazy with my questions, but I ask but why a lot. But why can't I? Why can't I? And can I figure out if I can? And is it appropriate? And I think those questions, they're so important to ask. But, you know, I think that they are, or I wouldn't be teaching them. I think they're accessible and I think they're appropriate, but we need a different set of tools. And the time that it's going to become most important to have these higher level skills is at a remote home birth. It's not that birth center that's 3 minutes from the hospital. If meds are needed, they're needed at 3 to 5 minutes. So it's likely that you might be giving them in a birth center 3 minutes from the hospital, but that's because it's the appropriate next step and you're moving to transfer, if that makes sense. But where you're really going to need them is when you're 40 minutes out and the volunteer EMS is 40 minutes from you. And then you have to decide. And that's really what I tell people. You have to decide where you're at with that and what you're willing to do. I don't have all the right answers. NRP has kind of notoriously not had engagement with the NRP steering committee with community birth providers. That has changed. Olga and I, my partner in teaching, have been working pretty diligently for about the last 2 years with AABC, ACNM, NARM, MANA, Elephant Circle, I don't want to miss anybody, Birth Center Equity, to get NRP, to get a midwife on the steering committee. And they just agreed to do that in the last couple of weeks.
Congratulations.
A community.
That's incredible advocacy. Thank you.
Right. Because right now we're just kind of coming up with, you know, Olga and I and Michelle Casimir and Lisa Varnes Epstein and Angelita Nixon, all these other, Andrea Dixon, all of these midwives that are at Karen Strange that are doing NRP in a community birth setting. We're just figuring out what we feel is right and what we've done and what, because we don't have this understanding guidance from the steering committee or the people who are teaching us, you know, they come out with really good intentions. If you're being taught from a hospital provider, a NICU nurse or a neonatologist, they have really, really good intentions. But what they don't understand is our reality, how many people we have, how often we can drill that, what equipment is even available to us, or how quickly we can get to them. They have a skewed sense of EMS response time and how quickly we can get to them. So think
for sure.
Reality, that true perception of what's going on for us in community birth is going
to be exciting. That's so exciting.
I'm super excited.
Well, congratulations on that advocacy work. Obviously, there's a lot of steps till you get to this place you're imagining, but a lot of them have been taken. And I think I thank you from the midwifery community because that's incredible work. Let's do some definitions for the listeners, because we may have some newer students and we may have some midwives who were brought up in a culture of community-based midwifery that didn't expand as the technology expanded. And I want to be really compassionate here because we don't know what we don't know, you know? Right. And there's a lot of uninitiated or partially initiated providers, midwives, in this very hodgepodge situation that is the U.S. with 50 different states and 5 different provider types and multiple different licensure, certification, school graduate. Like, it's a hodgepodge, and there's no homogenization. There's no standard of care, really, for us. We're all kind of figuring it out. And in fact, that's what you did in some ways, of being like, how can I figure this out in the best way? And so I just want to say a lot of compassion for those that are listening that might feel like, oh my God, I've never heard about this.
Right.
So let's walk through a few definitions. I would love for you to kind of take us from where we were to where you imagine the standard of care becoming. So where we were, let's say many of us are aware of or were brought up in like late 80s, early 90s midwifery, and then move us through to where we are now, or what you even imagine us moving to a decade from now, from an NRP perspective. Like, what was happening? What is happening? What do we wish was happening?
Okay. And what definitions do you want me to weave in? I want to make sure
Equipment, provider types, thresholds for referral, like things like that.
Okay. All right. So I started in EMS in the mid 90s. I was not in midwifery in the mid 90s.
Okay.
But I definitely, from talking to the midwives that mentored me and other midwives that have been in midwifery training NRP for a long time, there was a period of time where midwives couldn't even get oxygen, right? That wasn't accessible. And also felt as if possibly even breathing for the baby was inappropriate. Like, it was either overly interventive, or you could potentially cause a pneumothorax, and so you shouldn't be doing it. And so there was that whole period of time where it was very questionable, in my understanding, and please chime in here, that what should you even do? Is that even in our scope? And which is fascinating to me that we are still having these discussions today. We are still having these discussions today. Is that even in our scope? And also, like, kudos to you guys for doing those fights that said, yes, we should be able to save babies. We can save babies, and we will save babies. Because, you know, we would not be here if all of those fights had not gone on from all of you that were there. Saying, you know, we should be doing this, and this is important. So really, really grateful for all of that work that was done. I feel like when I came in to midwifery, you know, in the early 2000s with my training, and then, you know, becoming a midwife, it was the majority of people, and there's still pockets, as you said, like it's With the traveling, I think one of the most fascinating things to me is the disparity.
Yeah, me
We
too.
so integrated in Alaska. Midwifery is so integrated, and just to find how much, and you hear about it, but when I get to sit in front of it and see how much people are fighting to just be able to give good care, and it's just so different, and so
Yeah,
just really keeping that
that's
in mind.
and this the disparities in integration, the disparities in communication, the disparities in equipment, in training, in knowledge.
In
It's
access,
crazy around the country.
and they
Yeah,
can't
it's
even
crazy.
let anybody even let them have oxygen. Like, there's still midwives that have to fight to get oxygen. I don't even understand that. I feel so badly for them. I have deep, deep empathy for them.
Well, there's still states where it's illegal, Julie.
Right, to practice, exactly.
Yeah.
So, just I understand we're dealing with that, but I feel like on a whole, in the early 2000s, the majority of midwives who could, who were licensed, had access to oxygen, had access to training, were getting trained by their hospital providers. There was a lot of, well, I'm going to teach you this, but you don't need to know that. A lot of that. And that was certainly when I came into my birth center in 2014. I came to my birth center as a CNM, and it's a CPM founded birth center, because I knew that they had a million things that I had not gotten that I needed. And so I was seeking them out to teach me how to do community birth and how to do physiologic birth in this way that I knew in the back of my head was there, but I couldn't find elsewhere. And so to me, I felt like it was the most beautiful marriage ever. Because as CNMs and CPMs, we have so much to learn from each other. Like, the wealth of knowledge I feel like each model has that we can bring together is just a thing of beauty. And so that's what they did for me. I came in with this. I've been using a T-piece for 8 years. I don't want to give it up. We have to have some way to access meds if we need them. I did as an IO, as an EMT, with 4 months of training. That would be reasonable. It's in the NRP book. Let's talk about that. And they brought in perinatal psychology, and we're going to do this on the woman who just gave birth. We're going to do this skin to skin. We're going to do this with an awareness of the baby's soul and the mom's soul. And so it was just magical to me to bring that together. So that was kind of the 2010s for me. I know there were other people out there fighting to say, we can use the T-piece in a community birth setting. I accessed a midwife in the Midwest to help me with that, because she was using it. And I just knew that it could be done. And so I feel like there were just pockets of other people doing that then. Like, in the early teens, Olga and other people. And the reason we really, really, so sorry, and I need to step back a little bit because, like, I wasn't
Okay.
there. There are some things that are
Oh.
remiss. I do think for a long period of time, people were providing mouth to mouth, and being taught with
Yes.
that, and even accessing a bag valve mask to be
And
able
that's still happening for
to.
sure.
Right. And, I'm not going to say that that's completely out of line. I teach it in my course too, because there are times when you have to do it. But to me, those times are when you don't have the equipment that can help protect you and protect the baby. And so, just being aware of that, if you can access the equipment that can protect you and protect the baby, then you should do that. If you're able to do that, and then if
Definitely.
you can't, then you have other resources available to you. You always have those resources. So that's kind of the genesis, that bag valve mask. The T-piece is the next step. It makes it even safer for the baby. And we can go into, that deeper if you want to, either now or at another time, but it protects the baby. And so being able to do that, it provides more things to the baby that they need in order to transition successfully. So that was really the tea piece was introduced in like the couple of years before 2010 and in many, many hospitals. NRP brought it in 2006 and 2007, 2008, did some trials and then brought it in. So a lot of hospitals had been working with them, but I didn't really see it in community birth until we really started talking about it. And we being the several instructors who had kind of grabbed onto it. And you know, just like any sort of genesis, we all did it independently kind of around the country, which is really awesome, because to me, that just speaks to the rightness of it. Like
the limbic resonance. Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. that resonance. It's mm-hmm. that this mm-hmm. is coming into the world at this time, because mm-hmm. this is meant to come into the world at this time. And so mm-hmm. we're all listening to that resonance and grabbing onto it if we were alert for it. So we all kind of started talking about it and bringing it out. And just dealing with the hurdles of using it. You know, you need compressed air to drive a T-piece. It doesn't work on its own. A bag valve mask, you could be in the middle of a forest with it and use it to ventilate a baby. Same thing with mouth to mouth. There are some extra parts with a T-piece that you have to have. You have to access, to understand, and you have to know how to work. And so that's really our biggest goal, is to make that accessible to people. So that, like, to break it down into simple parts, to get rid of as much complication as we can, so mm-hmm. that it's accessible in a home birth setting, in a birth center
and
setting.
Where does the LMA fit in this conversation? Because that was introduced maybe even a decade before the T-piece as a good option to get a better seal.
Right.
And Karen Strange has sort of been beating that drum for years. And yeah. I think finally it's made its way in 20 years later.
Right. We've been teaching the LMA pretty consistently since we started in about 2015. And NRP just came out with an instructor update that said that it's reasonable to actually initiate all ventilation with an LMA. There's a lot around that we have to think about, imprinting on the baby, you know, but the bottom line is, and this is, you know, I've heard Karen say this, we all say this, if you don't have an airway for that baby and they need an airway, then we don't even get to talk about that other stuff, because we're not going to have a live breathing baby. So establishing that airway is really imperative. I do some demos in my course to really help people see. I initiate ventilations with a bag valve mask and then switch over to ventilations with a bag valve mask and an LMA. And I have a mannequin that has exposed lungs, so you can see how much the lungs are inflated. And then I switch over to the T-piece with a mask and then the T-piece with an LMA. And the difference is it usually gets gasps of awe, because the difference. Yeah. In actual ventilation of both the lungs and then, you know, at a different level, the alveoli, so that we actually get oxygen exchange. It's stunning, the difference there. Mm. So that is probably going to be the future. How NRP works is they typically will put out these instructor updates, but not make it part of the algorithm. So it's not part of the algorithm yet that you initiate ventilations with an LMA, but it probably, you know, judging from how they do things, it probably will be by the next edition. But if we think about that, and this is what I really encourage people to do, if the LMA allows you to give breaths, squeeze into a wonky corner behind their bed and next to their wood stove in their arms versus having to have a more controlled situation because you can't get a good airway. You can't, in that position, get a good airway. And here we are still right there, skin to skin, in their arms. We just have all of the things, all of the benefits of that, the intact cord, the pheromones, the exchange of mom telling baby to breathe and how to have its heart rate go and what temp to be and baby telling mom to not bleed, like all of those things that we want to keep intact. The LMA might make it that much more possible. So
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a really clear overview. Before we go to the future, let's really quickly, I would say my estimation is that a good 50% of midwives think that intubation is outside their scope in community-based birth and midwifery. Will you speak to this?
Yeah, you know, I for a period of time before the LMA really became prevalent out there, I taught intubation in my courses for community birth with hesitation, because you can damage a baby beyond repair with a poor intubation. And intubation is one of those skills that you need to do
as
it
muscle
often.
Memory.
There's muscle memory. You need to do it often. And even the people that do it far more frequently than us, like a pediatrician in a community hospital or a family practice doc in a community hospital, can struggle with it. So, you know, you really want an anesthesia provider, an ER doc, or a paramedic to intubate. Those are people that do it all the time. So I just... I also have hesitation about it. I teach it kind of as an extra in my courses, because there's some suctioning that if you just had a worst case scenario of a mech plug or a blood clot, you may need to suction below the cords. And so I teach and show a meconium aspiration device that has an integrated, it doesn't have a stylet. It has a firm tube and integrated suction. So there's less steps. It's more likely that you could do at least a partially blind suction with it. But again, that's going to be one of those rare things. That's a rare occurrence. The LMA is going to serve in most situations. And so the advent of the LMA into NRP and the advent of the IO, the intraosseous needle, into our NRP were a huge deal for us in my mind, because they're, you know, they're a lower fidelity. You can do it with a lower level of skill and training and frequency, you know, muscle memory, and there's less potential for harm. So,
well, that's where I'd love to go next. When we talk about meds administration, midwives are pretty freaked out about giving a catheter in the umbilical line, you know, an umbilical line. So, tell us about the IO, because that's a big development. And
it is
not
a big
mainstream yet. It's not mainstream,
not at all.
But it should be.
Not at all. I think it should be. I think it should be. What you're going to find is, if you're trained by a NICU doc or a NICU nurse, they're going to tell you, why would you go to the IO? The UVC is so easy, right? But the UVC is so easy for them because they do it 3 to 5 times a week, right? And you're not going to do it 3 to 5 times in 30 years. So... you're probably maybe going to come across a situation where it's indicated once. Like I said, that's kind of what the data shows, is once in a career, a midwife's going to encounter a situation where this could have made a difference. This could have helped and we didn't have it, or we did have it. So we do teach the UVC. We go through the steps, we show it. But again, with lack of familiarity and lack of equipment, it has a lot of pieces and a lot of steps to it that really can throw people off. Even nurses in a community hospital. Again, we use a three-way stopcock like once a year. So you pull them out and it's a different brand than you used last time. So there's just a lot of derailing that can happen, and a lot of really like finesse technique that can either make or break you placing your UVC. So that even the doctors that I worked with in community hospitals sometimes were successful, sometimes were not. So I think just understanding that mindset first of that NICU doctor, that NICU nurse that's going to say, why would you do that? There's this. Or why would you do that? They have a different frame of reference than us. And we shouldn't attack them for it. We should explain it to them. Like, here's our frame of reference, you know, here's the paradigm that we're working under, and we need to help you understand that. So sorry, I just wanted
to. So will
to...
you do that? Will you explain that for our listeners? Like, what is an intraosseous line? What does it do? How is it easy? Like, I think some people are like, their minds are blown. So maybe
an intraosseous is a needle that goes into the bone. So in the 90s, I placed them, again, with minimal training as an EMT. We would place them and use them for trauma resuscitation in adults. They came back into NRP as acceptable. and you put it in the baby's medial tibial, so it's just below their knee, towards the inside, and it can infuse fluids and or meds into the bone marrow space, and you can pretty quickly resuscitate with it. So it's acceptable. It's a choice along with the UVC in the NRP algorithm to do either an intraosseous or a UVC. So, and we do have a few birth centers that we go to that still choose a UVC. But when you demo the UVC, it's about 3 to 5 minutes to set it up, and it can be complicated. The intraosseous, you're somewhere between 10 to 30 seconds for placing it, with minimal training. Does it have dangers? Absolutely. You can fracture the bone, and you can infiltrate and cause an infection. But if we are doing fluid and meds in a neonate in a community birth setting, that baby has had at least 30 seconds of ventilations with a heart rate less than 60. It's had at least 30 seconds of ventilations with an LMA with a heart rate less than 60. And it's had at least a minute of compressions of ventilations with a heart rate still less than 60. This is a baby that is not showing any signs of life. And it is not going to be if we do not intervene at that point. And so
Yeah, the baby's in crisis.
that baby's in crisis.
That decision making takes a very different tact when you're at
It
that level of crisis.
does. Yeah. This is not a baby that just has some tachycardia or just needs some fluids. It's a little dehydrated. This is a baby that is in crisis and most likely will not live if you do not intervene. And the intervention time frame is somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes in the NRP system. So even if you're 3 minutes from the hospital, EMS is not there yet, and they are not trained in NRP, which is a whole nother discussion. And that's not their
Whole nother
fault.
discussion.
That's their paradigm. And so we need to help change that. And we're working on that. So you place the intraosseous and you can do the epinephrine per the NRP algorithm. And then you can immediately follow that with the fluid if you think you have an indication for hypovolemia. So this is that mom that just has a massive abruption that, everything was fine and then everything wasn't. Or the placenta comes out as a hat on the baby, this is the prolonged prolapsed cord where they just were fluid deprived for a period of time. The avulsion that we missed. There is going to be a time. There have been times, I work with a lot of birth centers and we talk about stories. Olga has taught a birth center that utilized the intraosseous in a home birth that they were in where they had a hypovolemic baby and had a save with it. So there are other stories like that out there. So, this is, I think it is a viable option for us. We just need training. And then we need to drill. And I think that's something that is just not talked about enough. We need to drill and we need to drill frequently, like monthly and at every birth, if you could, like just get it out. Like I encourage people who are new at birth to pull out the intubation head, drop an LMA, and ventilate for a minute or 2 minutes at every birth they go to. So that you just becomes like breathing to you, just becomes part of your body memory. And then you can do it and think of the other things that you have to think of.
That's such good advice. Of course, that's why we have scales and drills, is because we want people to be practicing all of the things. But this piece is really important. Well, so where are we going from here? And maybe do a little bit of imagining and dreaming, not just NRP's potential edits, but what do you hope is happening for community-based birth midwives in the area of resuscitation?
I hope that community-based midwives, first of all, can be trained by community-based midwives. I think that's the first most important thing, is that the people that are training us don't just read about what we do, but know what we do. Like they can feel in their bones what it's like to be the only person breathing for that baby while their partner is dealing with the placenta. They can feel that and they know that. I think that's the first and most important thing. And that is another thing that NRP, we are hoping within a few months, they have told us that they will be letting new instructors from accredited birth centers that are nurse midwives become instructors. Our hope was that it would be all midwives and all birth workers in all settings. We did not want it to be limited. That was not our goal. Our goal was to have it all midwives in all settings. But it's a start because at this point, you cannot become a new instructor if you're not actively delivering in the hospital. And that's been a barrier, a huge barrier. There are people that are grandfathered in, like myself and Olga and Karen and Andrea, but that hasn't been what the case was. So if we can get community-based instructors who understand, I think that's the first step. You need to be in a room with somebody who you know has done what you've done. And then we need to help people ask big questions. Like I said, what everything that we do is probably not right for every setting. But I want you to ask if everything we do is right for your setting. And honestly, in most cases, it is. I've encountered a few people where it was just like, this is what I'm dealing with, but it's rare. In most cases, when I come into a room, there's people who say, well, I'm going to learn this, but I'm not going to learn that. And by the end, they're like, oh, I can do all of this. I can.
That's
So
awesome.
I think really helping people to ask those questions and asking them alongside of them and being problem solvers with them. Like, what are your barriers? Like, and how do I remove your barriers? How can I, like, I've seen this in the setting.
I was going to say, like, there's probably even a step before that that maybe you're, not focused on, but I know you're focused on because I hear the feedback all the time from your instructors or your attendees. And that is like creating the environment where people feel safe enough to ask the questions and explain their yeses and their noes. And that's, I think, what you and Olga do so extraordinarily. I know Karen's done this for years as well, is creating this safe environment for midwives who didn't have anatomy and physiology and didn't have a ton of respiratory therapy or, the nuts and bolts education that comes with, say, nursing or what have you. We don't, sometimes we skip right over that. I mean, that's this weird thing with midwifery, right? Is we're skipping a whole lot of foundational information. And so people come with sort of chips on their shoulder or kind of these anxieties around what they don't know. And so creating the space where they can drop their shoulders, breathe, be present, and say, actually, I don't really know about this. Or actually, I never heard this before. I'm really afraid of this. And that's what I think you do before you even get to the point of like, how can I remove your barriers? So thank you for that, Julie.
Thank you. Thank you. And we have tried to be really aware of that. Both Olga and I can really get into our what we call our nursey nurse place. And it's like, help us to know that we're doing that because we don't do it consciously. We don't do it intentionally. We want this to be accessible to everybody. And we want anybody who's afraid or not agreeing to talk about it with us because we can talk through this and figure out those fears and how to help you with those. And so thank you for that because we strive to make that happen.
Well, I think you're achieving that, and it's in that line that I'm sort of in, which is midwifing the midwife, right?
Right. And
Such
that's
an
what we've been
important
saying
role.
for years. It's like I don't get to go to a lot of births anymore. But I feel like I'm midwifing so many midwives that it's okay. I get to do that with
Same
them.
friend.
And
Same friend. It's a new calling. Well, before we wrap up today, let's talk a little bit about the TP specifically, because that was the inspiration for this
It was.
conversation. That was a really insightful student question asked in Midwives Anonymous, and you and I got to connect last year and this year about this topic. We were really honored to have you teach at last year's Midwifery Wisdom Conference, and we hope to invite you back for this year. And you're out there teaching courses around the country, and you're teaching this regularly. And I certainly don't expect you to share your full curriculum, but can you give an overview for those who might be hesitant What is this technology? What do I have to carry, and why does it actually help the baby?
So the T-piece is it's called a T-piece resuscitator. The one that's really accessible in out of hospital is called a Neo-T, and it is self-contained. So a lot of people for a long time, and myself included, were used to the Neopuff, which is on the warmer in the hospital, and it's plugged into their wall, and it just seems completely unachievable, right? And it has a blender. So when you go through NRP's curriculum, it talks about the blender and blending compressed air and oxygen, right? So first, that mind flip of number one, do I need this big fancy piece of equipment? And number two, do I have to blend? And those were the questions that I asked when I came out of the hospital. Like, I'm used to blending. I'm used to this. What can I do? I was blessed. The midwives that had worked in our community had created incredible relationships with the hospital here. They were very integrated. And so I called up the chief of peds and I said, hey, here's my situation. I can access this Neo-T, right? That's easy for me. It's an easy thing and I can utilize it for resuscitations. And I would like to do that. But I don't think a blender is realistic for my setting. It's bulky, it's expensive, it's confusing. So people, if they aren't using it all the time, it derails you. You get lost in that instead of just being able to breathe for the baby. And what if I just initiate with compressed air? So I can get a different tank. It's a yellow tank with a yellow regulator. I get it from the same place that I get my oxygen from. And I initiate with compressed air and with the T-piece. And then if I need oxygen, because the sats say I need oxygen, which is the only reason I need oxygen, then I'll switch to oxygen. And she said, so you're starting with 21%. I said, yes. And she said, and you're moving to 100% if it's indicated. Yes. She said, you're great. You're fine. That sounds perfect. So that was kind of the start of was, and I think that's where most people get stuck. Number one, how do I resuscitate with room air, right? Because oxygen can cause problems. We know that, right? So we don't want to over oxygenate if they don't need it. But how do we initiate with room air? Well, it's accessible. It's another step. You know, I get that. For home birth midwives, yes, you would have to carry two tanks. You get the two small tanks, you set them side by side. Olga worked with a birth center in Texas that utilizes a baseball bag for a baseball bat bag because they're tall and it has the septum in the middle. So you could, for the bats, to keep a bunch of bats. So you could keep a tank next to a tank, all your, so that's one of the things we love to do is find equipment that people have found that works. Like you don't have to figure it, you know,
love that.
And then you don't have to have a blender. I've worked with two or three birth centers that do use blenders. You know, if you feel like that's accessible, okay, but you don't have to have one. I've done it for years without. I start with 21%. I move to 100% if indicated by the SATs. You do need to have a bag valve mask available at all times in case of equipment failure or in case of like a parking lot birth. I'm not going to take my two tanks and run out to the parking lot. I'm going to grab my bag valve mask and run out. But if you can have it available, it just follows you around. It goes to the tub, it goes to the bed, it goes to right outside the bathroom door, wherever you are. And you just like you would, same thing at a home birth, you always have your little tray that has your most important needs right there close with you. And you just would take that little bag and make sure that it's close when birth is imminent. So there's that setup is, I think, really onerous for people, first of all. But the questions are, what does it give you? Like, what are the benefits of it? And what are the concerns of it? The one other concern that I hear is the concern of it potentially causing a pneumothorax. Yes, it has a possibility of causing a pneumothorax. With ventilations, it has less of a possibility of causing a pneumothorax than a bag valve mask. That's why they're the preferred device, because they're pressure controlled. You can only give so much of a breath. When you get into giving CPAP, and that is just a whole nother discussion that I'd like to hold off for later, then yes, there's a lot of things that we would have to discuss that would be implications. So if you're giving ventilations in any way with a bag valve mask, with mouth to mouth, with a T piece, you need to be able to assess for, did you cause a pneumo? Any baby that has a resuscitation needs to have that expanded assessment of more frequent vital signs, listening to breath sounds and comparing them, or that is one getting less, is one more? What are their pulse ox readings? What are their sats? Are they starting to grunt? Are they starting to flare? Are they showing signs that you might have caused a pneumothorax, a little pop in their lung? It's going to come on slow in a newborn. So any way that you resuscitate, you need to be assessing for that. The T piece is not unique for that.
And then what does it do for the baby's lungs in those initial inflation breaths, or even if we're having some respiratory distress? Tell us what it's
So
doing
what
that's
it
different than
does
about.
is the first thing it does, the second that you put the mask on, if you have an appropriate seal, you will get a PEEP reading. So PEEP is positive end expiratory pressure. It is what opens up the alveoli in the first place for babies, because they're not open, right? They're scrunched and they are fluid filled after birth. And so if you're breathing for a baby and their alveoli are not open, what you're going to have is, say, this is like the bronchi and these are the bronchioles, you're going to have this air moving in and out, but no oxygen exchange, because the alveoli are where the oxygen exchange happens, right? And if they're closed, there's no oxygen exchange. So air's moving in and out, but no oxygen exchange is happening. And so we need those alveoli to open. PEEP is what opens them, or that baby's first vigorous cry opens up those alveoli, and then PEEP is what keeps them open. So those first PEEP breaths open up the alveoli, push the fluid out into the circulatory system, and make the alveoli available to have oxygen exchange across them. You put that mask on and you get that seal, it saves you time. You know immediately. If you've ever fumbled with a bag valve mask, you might do that for several times before you get a good mask seal. But the T piece gives you immediate feedback. Push a little bit harder on the nose. Oh, you're at five. You've got a good seal. Then five is the PEEP setting. That's what the pressure we're giving with PEEP. And then when you give the breaths, like I said, they're pressure controlled. So that's a huge thing. You're less likely to cause a pneumo with that when you're ventilating than with a bag valve mask. And it's going to hold those alveoli open between breaths. So with that mannequin, you can really see if you give breaths with a bag valve mask, you'll get open, close, open, close, open, close. With the T piece, you'll get open and they'll breathe. It'll go down, but not closed. Open. Not closed. So that those alveoli stay open and the fluid goes out and you get that oxygen exchange, which is a huge deal for babies.
Well, right now, the midwives in birth centers that are using it, the thing that they keep saying to folks who are kind of naysayers is they're like, we transport less babies now when we use this. Do you agree? Tell us about what you think
I
there.
agree. I think you have to be careful in why you're using it. And so, what I talk about is the reason that you're using the T piece, either for CPAP or for resuscitation, is because it's the appropriate intervention on the algorithm, right? So, if you're using it for ventilation, often what you're going to find is that that baby that would have gone into really tachycardic breaths and grunting and flaring and just doesn't improve, and we have to transfer, they don't ever go there. Because we opened their alveoli right from the start. So, right from the start with a resuscitation, we're not going to have to transfer that baby, all other things considered, right?
Of
There are
course.
babies that you need to transfer because they have an outlying issue. They're not better. But if you've fixed everything and everything is fine and you know why you did the resuscitation, all of those things, then you may be able to keep that baby. And that T piece may have avoided that. I think what a lot of people are talking about as well is providing CPAP. And it can be reasonable. The difference between PEEP and CPAP is PEEP is you're actively ventilating the baby, and PEEP is holding the alveoli open between breaths. CPAP is just like the snoring, people that use it at night. It is the newborn is spontaneously breathing, and CPAP is just holding those alveoli open between their spontaneous breaths. So what you have to be careful of is if you're providing CPAP, that is when the risk of pneumo goes increases in a baby that you're intervening in, number one. Number two, that it's at the appropriate place on the algorithm. So where CPAP is where blow-by used to be. It's basically on the right of the algorithm, and it says you either have a persistently cyanotic baby or you have labored breathing. So labored breathing is grunting, flaring retractions, wet lungs. So that's the appropriate time for CPAP. So then, to me, your question needs to be, are you providing CPAP because it's the appropriate place on the algorithm? It's then that's appropriate. If you're providing it to avoid transfer, that's not appropriate, right? It needs to be the appropriate intervention. If it's the appropriate intervention and it fixes them within a few minutes, then you have to ask yourself, are they fixed? Do I transfer a baby? That's fine. But do I have the ability for the expanded assessment and monitoring of that baby now? Because it deserves expanded assessment and monitoring. And this is where we don't have solid answers. NRP, again, doesn't delve this deeply into things with us. So how long is appropriate? I can tell you what I do. If I resuscitate a baby for any period longer than a few breaths, I watch that baby for 4 to 6 hours. I want to know that it's not going to go downhill a little bit later, right after I leave, because that's when those things show up. That's when GBS sepsis shows up. It doesn't show up right away. That's when meconium aspiration shows up, unless it's severe. It takes the baby a little while to go down that hill.
Yeah, I would say 6 or 8 hours. Well, this is a great segue into this AABC reality of this very early discharge, it feels like. Like, especially East Coast birth centers, they seem to send people home so soon. How are we going to integrate this knowledge with that protocol? Because that seems like a really important change.
There's no requirement to send people home early at all. There are birth
No,
centers,
it's just a,
that make
it's
those
just
decisions.
a,
And
but it's
so
become a common thing.
it's
And
become
so
a
I
common
feel
thing
like,
for sure. I think the training reality needs to be that can be your norm as long as everything is fine. I'm not uncomfortable sending our birth center did the same thing. Our state requires 3 hours. We can't go past 24. Our average was 4 to 6. And I felt comfortable. There were a lot of moms I felt comfortable sending. They were comfortable with nursing. They were established sending them home. But if you had outliers, you need an expanded assessment. And that means you need multiple pieces of data after the outlier to tell you that they're okay.
Yeah, that's a great way to
I have
say
a,
it.
yeah, I have a very mathematical mind. And so the way I teach it is if you're graphing, you can't establish a trend without three pieces of data. Like a lot of people will say two stables and I'm good. Well, two stables doesn't tell you your trend. Three stables does. You can't, if you have two pieces of data, you don't know if you're going up or down from here. You need three pieces of data. And again,
That's a great way to say it. That's a great way to say it. And this applies to home birth midwives as well, because oftentimes the home birth midwife has gone home 2 to 4 hours after the birth when everyone's stable. And this corrective protocol piece that you're putting in is like, if we had interventions, then we need to add this extra level of care. Or if we are not able, skilled, or we're too exhausted, we actually need to transfer for that care to have.
Right.
And that's a really important piece. And I think this isn't just for checking, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's. This is actually a liability piece as well, because if that poor outcome occurs and you didn't have that follow-up, that midwife definitely becomes liable for that outcome. So Absolutely. The transfer is almost, you know, legally protective as well as obviously medically protective.
Right. Yeah. And just the best and most right thing to do for the baby. And that's really where we have to sit, is what's the best and most right thing to do for a baby. You know, I've heard Karen say this before too. If that baby's not breathing, gosh, you really want to breathe for it. Like, that's how I teach it. Like, if you're hungry for air, wouldn't you want somebody to give you air? Like, isn't that a gift? You know, if the baby is struggling, doesn't it deserve more frequent monitoring? Because I think that it does. If it's struggling, it deserves for me to stay there and say, what are you doing, little guy? Are you getting better or are you getting worse? You know, and how
need some help.
How can I see that? Are you going to need more help from me? If you need it, I'm here to give it to you. And so really looking at it like that, and then also looking at other factors. What is going on? Why am I here? If I have no idea why I'm here, I am much more likely to transfer, you know.
Totally.
If I know, if I had a shoulder dystocia and I just, or some low heart tones and the baby was down and now I've got it done and everything's great, I'm much more comfortable with that. I'm still doing frequent assessments because the shoulder dystocia could have caused a pneumo, my resuscitation could have caused a pneumo. So I'm still going to do that expanded assessment. But if I have no idea why I'm here, I had a butter birth, everything was perfect, and now I'm in this prolonged recess, I'm going to take that baby in, because what they deserve is other ways of seeing what's wrong with them. A chest X-ray, labs to look at their white count, and are they working on an infection? So look at their blood gases. How are they doing? So does that baby need a higher level of assessment than we can provide, right? We can do the care, but can we do the assessment, and can we do the expanded, more frequent assessment? Do we have the staff, the people, the knowledge, the equipment? Do we have all those things? And if not, then it's the right thing to take them in.
Such helpful instruction and guidance. Julie, where can people find out more information about you and your courses so they can come and sit at your feet and learn with you?
We have a website, midwivesuntethered.com, and we have a Facebook page, Midwives Untethered, and we will respond to either of those. We do have Instagram. I'm working on that. So not the best at Instagram, but I'm social challenged.
Well, the website is awesome. And you have courses coming up this year?
We have a bunch of courses coming up this year, and we're actively scheduling more. Yeah. So we have a ton in the Midwest in May, and Florida in June. I think we have Florida in May as well. California in June. Some in upstate New York. Some are open, some are closed. So, but we're always open to hosting more courses. So if you want to host a course, contact us. And if you have a site and just a few things available, we can, host at your site. And as long as we can get 8 people, we can make it happen. Awesome. Yeah.
And of course we want to see you in November.
Yes, we want to be there.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Julie. I appreciate you again. This was a tremendous gift to the community. Really, really appreciate you. Go take a class, y'all. She's the best. Thanks,
Thank you, Augustine.